feel like there's going to be three messages. One is my sermon, and the other one is the message in the testimonies of our two brothers. And the third message is the visible message that points to gospel, to what Jesus Christ has done, and that is the communion, the Lord's Supper. And we are in a series called The Six Disciple Making, or Six Discipling Relationships, and today is the fifth one, and we have one more. And the question for today is, where is your Antioch? And the verse, the passage comes from Book of Acts, chapter 13, verse 1 through 3. Now in the church at Antioch, there were prophets and teachers, Barnabas, Simeon called Niger, Lucius of Cyrene, Manaen, who had been brought up with Herod the Tetrarch, and Saul. While they were worshiping the Lord and fasting, the Holy Spirit said, "Set apart for me Barnabas and Saul for the work to which I have called them." So after they had fasted and prayed, they placed their hands on them and sent them off. Do you know a super Christian? Someone you know who is truly mature that you know, someone who reminds you of Christ. Apostle Paul was a super duper Christian. I mean, he was able to say, "Imitate me as I imitate Jesus Christ." And I don't think you know many Christian leaders can say that of themselves. And yet, even a super Christian like Paul needed companions. He needed a group of people who would support him and pray for him and walk with him. Paul was not a lone ranger. On his missionary journeys, he always traveled with a small group of his co-workers or companions. Paul received God's direction through different means, and Paul did not keep going back to the Damascus road to receive a revelation with a mistaken notion that this is how God always speaks to me. Jesus spoke to Paul like that only once in his life. But there is one place really stands out as a setting where Paul was trained to listen to God's voice, and that was the Antioch church. In Acts chapter 8, we see a breakout of a great persecution against the church in Jerusalem, and many Christians, except the 12 apostles, were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria and to other parts of the Mediterranean world. And some of them went to places like Cyprus, which is an island off the coast of Turkey today, and Cyrene. Cyrene is a city in North Africa. And Acts 11 tells us that some Christians from Cyprus and Cyrene went to Antioch, and for the first time they began to share the gospel, not just to the Jews, but to the non-Jews, the Gentiles, or the Greeks and Romans. And surprisingly, a lot of people came to believe in Jesus Christ. And when the news of Gentile church plant in Antioch reached the disciples in Jerusalem, they sent Barnabas partly to check out what's going on and partly to encourage the new church. So Barnabas, you know, was the famous son of encouragement. But when he went to Antioch, he himself was encouraged by what God was doing at that church. And Barnabas felt a need for more solid Bible teaching, so he goes to Tarsus and he recruits Paul. And he brings Paul and Barnabas and Paul together. They teach the Antioch church for one whole year. And because of their teaching, the church became even more powerful and stronger. And more members came to that church. And that was the place, Bible tells us. Antioch was the place where the disciples, the followers of Christ, were first called Christians, people who have Christ in them. In the passage we read today, we see there were some other leaders in Antioch. They are described as prophets and teachers. So it seems that Antioch Church had a team of Bible teachers. Maybe Barnabas recruited all of them. Or maybe as Paul and Barnabas were teaching, they saw some teaching gifts in some of the members, and they recruited people from their own church. Of course, there's Barnabas and Paul. Barnabas is from the tribe of Levi. You know, they were the tribe of priests. So he was sort of like a Jewish priest. But he grew up in Cyprus, which is a Greek island. So probably he spoke Greek and Hebrew. He was someone who understood both cultures. And Paul, as we know, was a Pharisee who had persecuted the church. And he was born in Tarsus, which was a Roman city. And Paul himself was also fluent in Greek and Hebrew. He was comfortable in both cultures. And there was a Simeon called Niger. And Niger means black. So, you know, some people think that he was an African-American person from North Africa. You know, he may have been, but then he has a Jewish name. Simeon is a Jewish name, so he may just be another Jewish Christian who has dark skin. And there was also Lucius of Cyrene, and Cyrene was a Greek city on the north coast of Africa, and Lucius is a Latin name, so he was probably a Roman person or a Greek. And he may have been one of the Christians who went from Cyrene to Antioch to share the gospel for the first time there. And then the last person mentioned was Manaen, and his name is a Greek form of a Hebrew name. So he was a Hellenistic Jew. So again, you know, he was comfortable in Greek culture and the Hebrew culture. And Luke adds that Manaen was brought up with Herod the Tetrarch, and this was the Herod that killed John the Baptist. You know, this was the evil king, and he was also briefly involved in the trial of Jesus. So Manaen came from a powerful and a distinguished family. So the teaching team of Antioch was made of a very diverse collection of people. They came from different cultures. They came from different cities and different nations, different socioeconomic backgrounds, and yet they were a very good team. When Paul had finished his first mission trip, Paul does not go back to his hometown, Tarsus, but he goes back to Antioch. And Paul returns to Antioch again and again, because that is his spiritual home. That was his base for his missionary endeavors. And Antioch Church, there was this small group of church leaders that provided Paul with accountability, support, prayer, truth-telling, and discernment of God's voice. If one of the members in that small group had a vision or an insight, a new insight from God, he or she, you know, he would share that with the group. And that person's experience would be tested against God's word and tested against the collective wisdom of that small group. So they were pursuing God as a community, not as an individual. And if you feel that you're called as a pastor or a missionary or Bible teacher, you know, your personal call needs to be confirmed by the church, needs to be confirmed by the Christian community. If one believes that one is called as a missionary, and yet the majority of church leaders, the majority of church members think, we don't think so, you know, then you know, you got to doubt that call. You know, you probably are not called, you know, as a missionary or a pastor. If Paul needed a small group of Christians to grow and to be effective in his ministry, we also need a small group who can support us and challenge us and encourage us to grow. But we know from our experience that true community is rare. It's really hard to achieve a true community. And many people have been disappointed because their ideals of a true, you know, Christian community was not met. According to Scott Peck, a psychiatrist and a best-selling author, almost all groups, whether they are religious or secular, settle for what's called a pseudo-community. A pseudo-community. In a pseudo-community, everybody is nice. Everybody is polite. There's deference and peacekeeping, and nobody rocks the boat. But the pathway to true community, he says, is what he calls chaos. And chaos takes place when at least one person confronts an issue that has to be faced. He pulls off the veil of pseudo-community and confronts the real issue. And, you know, we know that that is not a pleasant experience. That is very uncomfortable. So very few groups take the risk of real confrontation and dialogue that is necessary to be a true community. In marriage, some spouses prefer to keep a lid on the most explosive issue. They settle for a pseudo-community relationship in their marriage. Coworkers may share an office space for years and yet never confront an issue, never talk about the elephant that is sitting in that room. A church leadership may become fixated on minor issues because they are too scary to deal with the real issue. I thought pseudo-community was and chaos was just an academic theory. But I got to see a confrontation and dialogue happen recently in one of our own small groups at church. Few people ask the uncomfortable questions. Are we growing as a small group? What should be the main focus of this small group? What can we do differently to foster deeper fellowship and growth? And, you know, it was very uncomfortable, you know, to confront that issue in that group. And yet it was needed. And the group agreed to do things, a few things differently. And what was clear from the dialogue was that, you know, everyone in that group was committed to make it work. They were committed to one another. Confronting and having a dialogue to build a true community, that's a better response than, you know, keep ignoring the issue or just not coming to the small group at all. Paul's small group in Antioch worshiped together, they fasted and they prayed together, and they sought God's direction together. And when they heard God's voice, they responded with full obedience. They were not there just for themselves. They were there for God and for other people. I think majority of people in our church are involved in small groups. Is there an issue that needs to be dealt? In our small groups, how can we build each other up? How can we help each other become more like Jesus Christ? What may need to change? When we are willing to confront and dialogue, we will move toward a true community. We all want spiritual growth, and one of the things we need for spiritual growth is our commitment, is our effort to build a true community. So we should not settle for a pseudo-community. We should confront, be willing to confront and dialogue, and that would move us, that would be a step toward a true community, and we will be able to listen and respond to God's voice. Well, that's the first part of the message today, and the second part, you know, the more exciting part, is the testimonies of our two brothers, Kevin Kim and Matt Kim, they had about 6 weeks of confirmation class, and they also spent some time reflecting on their lives and writing their testimonies. So, I wanna invite them to share their testimonies. As you know, confirmation is, this is not a baptism, so there's no water involved. Like last time, you might remember during the retreat, we went down to the beach and we dunked Paul Lee in the ocean water. I was trying to dunk him forward, but then because of the wave, he just went backwards, and it's just really awkward. But, I think, that's why it was memorable. There's no water, but because they have been baptized as a baby, as an infant, they both came from a Christian family, and their parents wanted their babies to receive baptism. So they are not getting baptized today, but they're now old enough to understand their own faith, and they have decided to declare their faith and follow Jesus Christ. So we will first listen to Kevin's testimony, and then we will listen to Matt's. So I want to invite Kevin to share his first.
Hello.